Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. Today, health and nutrition. A special comment about why we should be buying organic produce from the Organic Consumers Organization. Then, there's new research that shows that the better foods we eat, the more conscious we are in our choices, the new age. So if you're really healthy and you're 60, biologically, you're 40. If you're 50, you're about 35. But it works also in reverse, and I'll show you what happens to your biological age if you have not been eating healthy. Also, the more dairy, meat, and other unhealthy foods you eat, it's not good for you. Mindfulness therapy can help veterans with combat-related post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm not going to spend a lot of time today on health and nutrition because the remainder of our program will be devoted to a Conversations with Remarkable Minds guest. Science Set Free. Deconstructing the dogmas of scientific determinism and reductionism and the threats such as those dogmas pose. My guest, Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. He is a British biochemist, plant physiologist, who's experimented with innovative field theory in plants and animals, including humans. And we're going to talk about the deeper structures of biological development. His research has included efforts to reach a greater understanding of memory, perception, cognition, as well as the forces that unfolds an organism. And over the past several decades, he developed the theory of morphic resonance and morphogenic fields that are intrinsic to all species. And while in India, he became a close associate of the late Father Griffiths, an internationally renowned Dominican monk and mystic and spokesperson for inner spiritual dialogue between religions. He is also the author of a new book, Science Set Free, 10 Paths to New Discovery. This will be a very challenging conversation. You'll want to hear it. So let your friends know now. Now, on Earth Day, I'm going to have Dr. Jane Goodall and Dr. Vandana Shiva. There'll be a total of 4 guests. Powerful program lined up. You won't want to miss that. Let's begin. I have been an organic farmer, certified organic farmer, for a long time. Many of you, in fact, thousands of you, remember the weekends we used to spend together at the Furtworth Farm in upstate New York, about 20 minutes outside of New Paltz, in a place called Stone Ridge. And it was called Stone Ridge because it was all stone, hard stone, including granite, making it a very challenging place to grow food. So I drained a pond, let the water out of it for 3 months, and used that to build up about a foot of topsoil. People would come up on the weekends. Generally, the place held 50 people, but on Saturday, people could come up for the day. We'd have as many as 500 people. And there would be 16 picnic tables, long picnic tables, filled with gourmet vegan delights of every type. In the evenings, there'd be campfires where we had this big camp pit where we would have sing-alongs. Yoga in the morning, at sunrise, running in the mountains. It was a wonderful experience. People would leave there with gigantic bags. I'm talking about big garbage bags stuffed with organic produce that I gave them for free. And church groups and food centers could take all the food that they wanted. People learned from seed to salad why it's so important to use natural methods. I would like to think that many people are still doing that today. And I know they are. The organic movement has grown. This is the latest. This is from the Organic Consumers Organization. It says, why we should all eat more organic food. And I'll quote this. First, organic food is more nutritious. And indeed, I have at least 17 studies from the peer-reviewed literature showing the higher nutrient densities in organic food. Organic food, especially raw or unprocessed, contains higher levels of beta-carotene, vitamin C, D, and E, health-promoting polyphenols, cancer-fighting antioxidants, flavonoids, that help ward off heart disease, and essential fatty acids and essential minerals. In fact, each day, I'm seeing more and more people starting their morning with juice. In fact, just yesterday, while coming back from, I take a walk up to my store each day, I was stopped by a person on the street whose family owns an institution, a very famous institution, Zabar's. And I know Saul Zabar for a long time, and his wife. Very much health advocates. They really take care of themselves. And she commented, Ms. Zabar commented about, boy, people are juicing. And I said, like never before. And the idea is that historically those people would have gone over either making coffee at home or buying coffee from a local coffee place, which was always crowded. Now hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people are getting juice each morning at just one store. And they're getting organic juice. In part, they're getting it because it is organic. Secondly, because they can make their own juices, meaning they can, if they want kale or whatever, they get it. And there's no extra charge. And because it makes them feel better. You would be amazed if you just stood outside of a health food store and if you knew the people's backgrounds, how many people from the New York Ballet, how many people working on Broadway, major Broadway shows, and the arts, who are high-level performers, start their day with fresh organic juice. They're very health conscious. They're wise. They know that the healthier their body, the longer they can perform, and therefore a longer career. Interesting, it was about, I'm guessing, 15 years ago that a couple, a friend of mine, who are well-known in New York, invited me out to their Hampton home. I had just finished a national championship, and I was dead tired, and come on out for the day. It'll be quiet, and you can just rest. Fine. So I went out, and I'm sitting out at about 9 o'clock in the morning on a swing in a beautiful lawn, just enjoying the butterflies, and my friend comes out and says, by the way, Gary, I have so many friends who are interested in health. Would you mind if we just made a little something for them to come by for lunch, just for a few moments? I said, no, I don't mind. So we went into the Amagansett Market and got all the fresh produce. And she's not a cook, so I made the meal for everyone. And so I said, how many people are coming? One or two? She said, well, how about 30? I said, 30? How are 30 people coming for lunch? Well, you know, they found out you were here and they all have health questions. So I went ahead and I made the lunch for 30 people and I made a 7-course meal. And then I went out even more tired than what I was when I got there and sat on the bench while they were all in. And one by one, they all came out to ask questions. Now, what was surprising to me is some of these, and I won't mention names, but one of the greatest violinists in the world, and all of them were asking a basic question. If I ate organic, and if I juiced, and if I detoxed, would that help me overcome X, Y, and Z conditions? And I explained that it was a little more complicated than that. It depended upon their age, the state of those illnesses in their body, and how much they were willing to forego of normal habits, like drinking the coffee, which in my opinion is one of the worst things you can do in the world, as compared to having the organic green coffee bean, which has specific nutrients that help your immune system, help you lose weight, but not the brew, not the caffeine. And would you be willing to give up your desserts, your cheesecakes, your snacks, the big steak that you eat? And most of them sheepishly said, no, that's not easy to do. One person, in fact, that day, who was a composer, said, They're not giving up cigarettes. They're not giving up coffee. And they're not giving up alcohol. But they're sure that there must be some pill they could take. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't know of any pill that's going to undo the damage from all that. At about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, having nonstop spoken with people one after the other, I finally saw a break of about 2 minutes, and I scooted out the back of the property, walked to the train station, and I took a train home, getting back about 10 o'clock at night, having had one of the most exhaustive days in a long time. So much for... And I was thinking about this. When it comes to health, nobody ever thinks that there's an imposition in a restaurant, a Broadway play at intermission, to ask a health question. It's that kind of the universal open door idea. And of course, as much as I can, I try to always answer everyone's questions. And thereafter, I decided it's just better to go down to Florida and go to my home, my own ranch, where I knew nobody's going to come and ask me to cook a 30-course lunch. But I was encouraged. I was very positively inclined that at least they were aware of the concept of organic. This is 15 years ago. Today, everyone is aware of organic. That doesn't mean they're going to use it, but they're aware of it. It's in our consciousness. And in certain places, for example, today, we hired a new scholar on our staff, a research scholar, to help do in-depth research and verifications of the information I use in my commentaries and research reports. This person had been living and researching in Santa Fe. Well, this person was talking about how everyone in Santa Fe is fully aware of the organic movement and the importance of buying locally grown non-GMO items and having fresh juices throughout the day and eating healthier fare. So I'm happy about that. I really feel that we've made enormous progress. Now, also organic on average is 25% more nutritious in terms of vitamins and minerals than products derived from industrial agriculture, since on average organic food shelf prices is about 20% higher than chemical food. This makes it actually cheaper gram for gram than chemical food, even ignoring the astronomical hidden cost. Remember, what does it cost you to be sick? How much will you pay for cancer, arthritis, heart disease therapy? You have to add that into the cost of food. But they never add that into the cost of a hamburger, hot dog, french fries, or colas, do they? Never. What does it cost to have diabetes? How much do you have to spend in buying larger clothes or letting out clothes if you gain weight? Why isn't that added into the cost of a super burger? And they should put it on the menu. $1.99 for the burger, $3,000 for a year's supply of blood pressure and lowering medications, $75,000 for your coronary bypass operation. Total cost of burger, $170,000. But we don't do that, do we? But we should. Also, the levels of antioxidants in milk from organic cattle are 80% higher than normal milk. Organic wheat, tomatoes, potatoes, cabbage, onions, and lettuce have 40% more nutrients than non-organic foods. And organic food contains qualitatively higher levels of essential minerals like calcium, magnesium, iron, and chromium that are severely depleted in chemical foods grown on pesticide, nitrate, fertilizer-based soil. In fact, the UK and US government statistics indicate that levels of trace minerals in non-organic fruit and vegetables fell by up to 76% between 1940 and 1991. Organic food is pure food, free of chemical additives. Organic food doesn't contain food additives, flavor enhancers like MSG, artificial sweeteners like aspartame or high fructose corn syrup, contaminants like mercury or preservatives like sodium nitrate that can cause health problems. Eating organic has the potential to lower the incidence of all forms of learning disorders, cancer, coronary heart disease, diabetes, allergies, osteoporosis, migraines, dementia, and hyperactivity. And also, it is safer. Organic food doesn't contain pesticides. Now, on yesterday's program, I mentioned that a new study by the World Health Organization showed 450,000 citizens in one small area suffered from a pesticide-induced kidney damage. And that is just one study. I remember when I was out in California last, and I try to get out there at least twice a year, I always like to go up to the growing valleys, like the San Joaquin Valley, and speak with farmers and the harvesters. And now, the farm workers, you'll see them with masks on, you'll see them with rubber boots, rubber gloves. They're covering their body. Why? Because when you see the older generation of farmers, you'll see that they have substantial ulcerating sores on their arms and legs and feet where pesticides were sprayed on the crops and they were rubbing off on them. So you don't have these pesticides. More than 400 chemical pesticides are routinely used in conventional farming, and residues remain on non-organic food even after washing. And children are especially vulnerable to pesticide exposure. And one class of pesticides, endocrine disruptors, may be responsible for early puberty and breast cancer. Pesticides are definitely linked to asthma and cancer. And organic food isn't genetically modified. Under organic standards, genetically modified crops and ingredients are prohibited. And organic animals aren't given drugs. Organic farming standards prohibit the use of antibiotics, growth hormones, and genetically modified vaccines in farm animals. And just remember, when the meat you're eating or the dairy you're drinking is not organic, there's a high probability that you have hormone laces in the beef and the dairy consumed, and that can increase the rates of breast, testicular, and prostate cancers. Organic animals aren't fed slaughterhouse waste like blood and manure. Eating organic means eating grasses. Remember, all your hoofstock were meant to eat grass, and that is what they're not eating. They're fed all forms of artificial mixes in feedlots. So organic means less risk of Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease, the human version of mad cow disease, as well as Alzheimer's. Organic animals aren't fed arsenic. Organic animals aren't fed byproducts of corn ethanol production, which increase the rate of E. coli contamination. Organic crops aren't fertilized with toxic sewage sludge or waste, or irrigated with E. coli contaminated sewage water. Organic food isn't irradiated. Cats fed a diet of irradiated food get multiple sclerosis within 3 months. Organic food contains less illness-inducing bacteria. Organic chickens are free almost most of the time of salmonella and has reduced incidence of Campylobacter. And organic dairy has environmental benefits, shades of green, and quantifying the benefits of organic dairy production. So those are just some suggestions for those of you who wish to understand why I eat organic. I'm a certified organic farmer, and I'm a beekeeper, and I've never had bee colony collapse. But an awful lot of people have, and I did a program this week, a full hour on Progressive Commentary Hour, on bee colony collapse and what causes it. We know what causes it. Now, one other thing here. This is in the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. After a 16-year follow-up, people who consumed a Western-type diet, including a high intake of red and processed meats, whole dairy products, and fried foods, were more likely to die prematurely and to suffer from various chronic illnesses, including heart disease, stroke, cancer, mental health disorders, compared to people who avoided such dietary patterns. Researchers analyzed 5,000 participants from the Whitehall study in London and scored dietary patterns using the Alternative Healthy Eating Index. And that's important to understand. So, also, a daily serving of soda increases the aggressive prostate cancer risk by 40%. And this was published in the done at Lund University in Sweden and published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. I'll quote, "Soda is quite possibly the most vilified food beverage on the market, and for good reason. The beverage offers zero nutritional value, all the while increasing the risk of countless diseases, but even with everything we know as a society, soda sales continued upward, and so did a number of studies showcasing the negative impacts of a popular drink. According to the latest study, one soda per day increases a man's risk of prostate cancer by 40%. Compared to someone who does not drink the beverages. And finally, 30 years of age? Okay, it's the new 45. Today's adults are getting diseases 15 years faster than their grandparents. This is the latest study, and here is on the subject, and here is what it says. I'll just quote the first paragraph. As vaccines pump the population full of mercury and thimerosal, as genetically modified crops alter human DNA, as biphenyl A in plastics and can linings alter the hormonal structure of the human body, as pesticides pollute the land and water, more people are experiencing diseases sooner in the United States. According to newest findings, people today are being diagnosed with diseases 33% faster than their grandparents. Age 30 has become the new 45 in reference to onsetting diseases. The abundance of diseases being diagnosed as an early age only means the modern era of pharmaceutical drugs and chemicals is not working and is tearing down the quality of life for countless people, perpetuating the root of the problem. What does this trend suggest? If this generation continues to pretend that everything's okay, teaching their kin that the current path is working, then the next generation will grow dependent upon symptom-suppressing drugs and welcoming diseases as early as 20. For a thriving, clear-minded generation to rise up, the root problems need to be addressed and actions need to be taken. So, that is just part of that study. A break and back with my guests. Please stay with us. Marvin Gaye. He wrote that album himself, and Berry Gordy, the owner of Motown, didn't want to produce it. Thought it was a bad album. Turned out Marvin Gaye was right. It was the most successful album in the history of Motown. My guest is on the phone from England, Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. I gave you his bio and background and his new book, Science Set Free, earlier on at the beginning of the program. Nice to have you with us today.
Good to be with you again.
You have identified 10 pillars, as it were, of the religion of scientism. You define them, deconstruct them, and then follow that up with a different interpretation of these pillars based upon newer scientific evidence and discoveries. Would you please go through these one by one so we can understand them? Take your time. You're on for the rest of the program, no breaks, so you can give us a comprehensive answer on each one.
Okay, well, maybe I should just summarize the 10 dogmas. These are the default assumptions of most scientists and indeed most educated people. And the point I'm making in my book, Science Set Free, is that when we look at these assumptions and treat them as scientific hypotheses, we can then look at them, compare them with the evidence, with recent scientific findings, and see whether they're true or not. If we take them as assumptions, as most scientists do, they don't even know that they're assumptions or beliefs or dogmas. They just think they're true. And that's what makes the scientific belief system very often come across so arrogantly, because many of its believers think everyone else has opinions and beliefs and faith and stuff, but they know the truth. And what I'm arguing is that these are really beliefs. And the first one, and the most fundamental, is that nature is machine-like or mechanical. And this became the foundational assumption of Western science in the 17th century, when modern science got going. And it said the universe is a machine. They thought it was like clockwork. Animals and plants are just machines. Humans are just machines, except they have a rational mind, which is not material. That was called Cartesian dualism. But the body is a machine, and animals and plants are machines, and that's why today, where this is still the official theory, we have industrial agriculture and factory farming, because animals and plants are just machines. So it's not really a theory that can be tested by experiment, this mechanistic view. It's really a metaphor. And a much better metaphor for nature is an organism. The whole universe started with the Big Bang, a bit like the hatching of the cosmic egg, and it's been growing and developing ever since. And that's much more like an embryo or a plant than it is like a machine. So the first assumption is simply a metaphor. It's not a proven theory, and it's a metaphor that's just not very appropriate most of the time. We're not, as Richard Dawkins says, lumbering robots. We're people. We're living organisms. And the main alternative to the machine theory of life is that living organisms are living organisms, which I think makes so much more sense. The second assumption is that matter's unconscious, that the universe is made up of matter that has no mind, no soul, no consciousness. It's literally inanimate. And the whole universe is made up of this unconscious matter. And we're made up of unconscious matter, too. That, of course, leads to an obvious problem. It's really the fatal flaw of the materialist worldview that science is based on, is the fact that we are conscious. We ought not to be, according to this theory, but we are. And so the way materialists try and get around that is to try and say we're not really conscious. Our consciousness doesn't do anything. It's just a kind of illusion. It might just as well not be there. So that's an assumption that, you know, is pretty implausible. And some materialist philosophers, including Thomas Nagel in New York, have really recently broken ranks, just don't think it will do. Nagel wrote a book recently called Mind and Cosmos, How the Materialist Neo-Darwinian Conception of Nature is Almost Certainly False. And what he's saying, it's a long title, a bit confusing perhaps, but what he's saying is that we simply can't explain the universe as if it's made up of unconscious matter. There must be some kind of mind or mental aspect to matter all through nature, not just in human brains. The third assumption is that the laws of nature are fixed. The laws that govern everything are the same today as they were at the moment of the Big Bang. This, again, is just an assumption. It can't be proved. And I think it makes much more sense to think of the laws as evolving, or better still, of being more like habits. And in my theory of morphic resonance, indeed, I suggest there are habits in nature. Each kind of thing tunes into a collective memory, and each individual contributes to it. The fourth assumption is the total amount of matter and energy is always the same. except at the moment of the Big Bang, when all the matter and the energy are supposed to have sprung into being from nothing in a single instant. Thereafter, the total amount's not supposed to have changed. Now, most people think this is a sacrosanct law of nature, but actually, physicists themselves haven't felt so bound by it. And in the last 20 or 30 years, they've invented or hypothesized two new forms of matter and energy, dark matter and dark energy, so-called because we can't detect them in any direct way. They've introduced dark matter and dark energy to make their equations of the universe fit the facts. And you can add in just as much dark matter and energy as you like to make the equations work. And these now make up about 96% of the universe, according to contemporary physics. So the regular matter and energy that we learned about at school is less than 4% of what's really there. And who knows if the total amount of dark matter and energy is always the same, or indeed whether it can be converted into regular matter and energy. So this is very much an open question. The fifth assumption is that nature is purposeless. Nature is just a machine, and being a machine, it has no purpose of its own. So the universe is headed nowhere. Evolution is meaningless. It has no direction or goal. We're just the product of blind chance. Again, this is a metaphysical assumption, a kind of philosophical assumption that comes from the materialist theory of nature. It's not something that's been proved by experiment. In fact, nature's full of purposes. We have purposes. Where do they come from if matter's purposeless and nature's purposeless? So this is very much at least an open question, and I think probably just false. Assumption six, everything we inherit biologically is in the genes, or epigenetic modifications of genes, or carried through the cytoplasm, like in mitochondria. I don't need to go into the details, but in essence it's saying everything we inherit is inherited materially. And the biggest emphasis is, of course, on genes. Well, it's turned out as a result of the Genome Project that genes are grossly overrated, and there's now, in the heart of biology, a problem called the missing heritability problem. Turns out that about 75% of inheritance can't be explained in terms of genes. So this assumption, which has been the basis of biology for a very long time, 100 years at least, it turns out to be false, and it's coming unraveled quite fast. The eighth assumption is that our memories are stored inside our brains as material or physical traces. They're stored in modified nerve endings or phosphorylated proteins or other molecules. Well, no one's ever managed to find memories in brains. They've looked hard enough for 100 years or more, and they've been ever more elusive. I think that's because they're not there. I don't think memories do store I don't think brains do store memories. I think they're more like TV receivers or radio sets that tune in to what's happened in the past. It's a kind of resonance across time, which I call morphic resonance. And this, surprisingly, fits the facts much better than the conventional memory and brain theory. Assumption eight is that the mind is inside the brain. The mind is nothing but brain activity. All your thoughts, all your experiences are inside your head. Now, again, this doesn't fit the facts. When I look at something, and I'm looking at a tree right now out of the window, the tree I'm seeing is, according to conventional science, inside my head. Light comes in, changes happen in the retina, impulses up the optic nerves, changes in the brain. And the brain then generates the sensation of a tree, a representation of the tree in three dimensions and in color. And it's all supposed to be inside the brain. But I don't think it is. I think my image of the tree is out there right where it seems to be. It's in my mind but not in my brain. And I think my mind's extended out beyond my brain in every act of perception. So the idea that mind's confined to the inside of the brain goes against our most immediate experience. There's no proof for it, and yet most people accept it quite uncritically. It's just an assumption, and a pretty bad assumption. Dogma 9 is that psychic phenomena are illusory. Things like telepathy may appear to happen, but they don't really, because the mind's inside the head, and therefore thoughts can't have any influence at a distance. Again, this is a dogmatic belief. Many militant atheists and materialists believe this. They get terribly angry if anyone talks about telepathy or says there's evidence for it. But most people have experienced it, and there's now very good scientific evidence that it's real. But this meets with a kind of dogmatic resistance from people who are completely committed to the materialist worldview. And dogma 10 is the assumption that mechanistic medicine is the only kind that really works. That's why governments and insurance companies spend the vast majority of their budget on mechanistic medical practices and research, and more or less ignore complementary and alternative medicine. Now, the U.S. is better placed than most countries. The National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine does pay for research in these areas, but its budget is currently 0.4% of the National Institutes of Health budget. So although it's there, it's very, very small proportion. The usual assumption by dogmatic materialists is that complementary and alternative medicines and various faith healing and so forth and the power of prayer may appear to work, but that's only because people would have got better anyway, or it's just the placebo effect. But the only kind of medicine that really works is chemistry and physics based on drugs or surgery. Now, of course, drugs and surgery do work in many cases, but the conventional assumption is these are the only kinds that work, and that, I think, greatly limits medicine in its potential. It inhibits the official funding of integrative medicine, and it promotes the interests of drug companies. And all this is happening because of, no doubt, vested financial interests, but also because of a dogmatic belief in this materialist worldview. So these 10 dogmas that I've just summarized are the default worldview of most educated people. It's what most people are supposed to believe. It's what most governments and educational institutions and businesses are based on, most corporations. And it's the worldview that most educated people pretend to believe when they're in public. I don't think many really do believe it, but it is the kind of standard worldview, a kind of standard issue worldview that most educated people are still brought up to believe in.
I appreciate these insights. I'd like to take an extended thought from you on one of the things you just mentioned, because today it is my impression that there are professional organizations and websites devoted to what is termed evidence-based science and science-based medicine. My understanding, after reviewing them, is that these are poorly meeting that criteria, and many of them are not evidence-based at all, especially the pharmaceutical ones. And there's evidence and facts are cherry-picked to support particular ideological agendas, which is often socioeconomically based. I have my own insights to some of these people. You look at David Gorski, Stephen Barrett from the Quackbusters, Stephen Novella and Jim Moore and Seth M. Mundkin, also James Coyne, and then journalist people like Brian Deere in Britain or Seth Kelichman. They support these particular sites. And then actually some of their blogs can be humorous because they're trying so hard in almost a ruthless effort to show that there's only one truth, the official truth, the orthodox truth, and anyone else that varies from that truth is to be attacked. And then on the other end of that, you have People like Novella and Dennard and Dawkins and P.Z. Myers, they're card-carrying atheists. Now, I don't have any problem with disbelief in a deity. Original Buddhism was basically that. And many schools of Greek philosophy were humanistic and deeply ethical and didn't care one way or the other about the existence of a god. I do believe that our dealing with the human condition is fundamental and a priority, and people can live very moral and ethical lives without a belief in God, and therefore religious beliefs are secondary. But when atheism becomes a religion unto itself and marries itself with scientific determinism, that expels mystery and sacred of the world and universe altogether. There are dangers, in my opinion, to society and people's health when that happens. Could you please address the relationship between this defense of the orthodox or your 10 points and atheism and scientific determinism and how it impacts us?
Well, I think they are closely related, particularly with militant atheism. I mean, I know quite a lot of atheists myself. I'm certainly not one myself, but, you know, some of my friends are atheists, and most of them are quite moderate and don't try and force their belief onto others. Militant atheists are like proselytizing evangelicals. They're trying to convert people to their point of view, and they have a very, very big agenda. They've identified their worldview with science, basically with these 10 dogmas I've been talking about, the materialist worldview. They've made it a kind of religion. And I think that's a dangerous thing. Science is not supposed to be a belief system. It's a method of inquiry. I've recently had some dealings with these people because, as you may know, there was a big controversy recently about my TEDx talk. I gave a talk at the TEDx event in London in January 2013 this year, and it went up on the website, and thousands of people watched it, and everything was going fine. But then it was denounced by Jerry Coyne and P.Z. Myers on their blogs, and both of them are, of course, militant atheists. They attacked TED for putting my talk up there and attacked me, and TED rather foolishly took it down. And then they put it on a separate blog, a kind of naughty corner of the internet, with a statement from their so-called scientific board saying it was pseudoscience. Well, I could easily refute all the points they made, and they had to withdraw those accusations. But it's triggered off a huge debate. There's been more than 5,000 comments on my talk and their removal of it from their official TEDx website. And more comments than any other TED talk has attracted. And they're running about 10 to 1 in favor of me and against the militant atheists. They did the same with a talk by Graham Hancock. They took that down, and this has led to an enormous discussion on the internet. And I think what it's highlighted is that the highly irrational agenda of these militant atheists and defenders of materialism, until now, they've more or less got away with it. But the tide at this very moment, I think, is turning, and more and more people who are opposed to this dogmatism are coming out and saying so. And you know, I think they're just losing their hold over the media. They've still got a very big influence on the mainstream broadcast media and newspapers. But I do think that it's a coordinated attempt to try and discredit parapsychology, psychic phenomena, consciousness studies, alternative and complementary medicine, and, of course, every aspect of religion, including, in many cases, meditation and things for which there are proven benefits, in the interests of an extremely ideological, dogmatic agenda. These people are aggressive, they're organized, they're very, very active on the internet. But most of them are pretty poor scientists. And if you look at the claims they've made and the claims that various so-called skeptics have made, they really, most of them don't hold up. There's a website, I don't know if you've seen it, Gary, but there's a website I and a few others helped to organize in Britain called skepticalinvestigations.org.
Yes.
And what we do on the website is investigate skeptics. And it turns out that most of them, you know, are pretty disreputable. I mean, there are some of them who've told lies, who are outright liars. We're not talking here with a kind of gleaming bunch of top scientists. We're talking about a pretty shabby bunch of people for the most part. And they've had a disproportionate influence. They've been able to punch far above their weight. But I think that most people are frightened into appearing to believe with them. But I find when I give talks in scientific institutions, the great majority of scientists are actually much more open-minded than these militant atheists. I don't think they speak for the science community, which they claim to do. Well, I think they speak for their own ideologically based militant brand of atheism.
Let me give you an example of what you're just saying. I was invited, based upon a study that I did, a clinical study, to a World Congress on Anti-Aging Medicine, and all the participants there, about 7,000 scientists from all the major institutions, I was to do each of the presenters were to do a 22-minute report, and they show it on, they were all watching and reading it on their little laptops, and then they can ask you questions. I went off script. And I said, I'm listening to your reports today, all very interesting, on how to slow down and wherever possible reverse the aging process and the amount of research money that you're seeking or have spent. I'd like to show a different paradigm. And so at that point, I invited out onto the stage a group of individuals. One, a former professor at New York University. Another was a child named Ortega. And the parents, two New York City police officers, another, a woman, a 35-year practicing nurse. And I said, this woman had advanced Alzheimer's and so severe that she was not able to tend to herself and was being taken to an Alzheimer's assisted living center. And today she has completely normal brain activity and still is able to teach and articulate her thoughts. And to my knowledge, this is the first time that we actually have a clinical study of this. Here's a person with multiple sclerosis, advanced, a plumber from New Jersey, Kenny. He's completely normal. All of his neurological reports, his MRIs show he has remyelinated his sheath and has reversed brain damage and central nervous system damage. Here's a kid with advanced autism who's completely normal, number one in his class now. And I went through all these different conditions. And I said, this was all done without any medical intervention. This was purely lifestyle and behavior modification. And it took about 16 months. And with that, I finished. Each one of them had a chance to tell 2 minutes of their story. And I finished the whole report in about 16 minutes, didn't even take my 22 minutes, walked outside, and you could not believe how many hundreds of people, so many scientists and physicians, filled that corridor. We estimate about 500. And I was talking with one of them. Now, this is typical. They said, this is fascinating. And I said, would you like the protocols? You're welcome to come to New York or call me and I'll share the protocols. This is all open. And the man kind of stood there for a moment and says, I'm fascinated by it, but I dare not try it. Why not? Well, because you can't step out of boundaries when practicing medicine today. Or practicing science, your research grants will dry up. You'll be brought up on charges of unethical or quack medicine. I don't want to end up on a quack site. And I said, which quack site? You're afraid of Stephen Barrett? And I saw this look. Well, this Barrett fella has been, and once again, when you investigate their background, you don't find that they have actually contributed anything constructive. It's the people you're referring to or attacked that are actually leading the way into these new paradigms. In any case, I just after that, when I got back to New York, I saw an article about medical McCarthyism. And guess who it was about? It was about taking my statements on sugar, my articles that I've written, and on sugar, on mercury in vaccines, thimerosal, on fluoridation, etc. And they looked at the peer review literature of what I'd stated. Then they looked at Stephen Barrett's denunciation of me in those statements. And they found and they put all the articles up there, that he was wrong on every single point. And I was right on every single point. That's fine. The article's up on progressiveradionetwork.com and GaryNall.com. People can read it. But that doesn't make the news. What makes the news is when someone like yourself at a TED conference or myself or any number of 80,000 alternative practitioners actually are able to open up a new dialogue and look at a problem differently. We become excoriated for stepping just 1 millimeter outside of official scientific acceptance. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I think what you're describing is a very clear example of this kind of taboo and this prohibition of free thinking and so on. I think that's why I've written this book, really. It's called Science Set Free, because I'm hoping that the sciences and the medical sciences can be set free from this terrible constricting dogmatism. I think there are several ways forward. I mean, like you, I've come to the same conclusion. Most people stay within that and don't rock the boat out of fear. They'll lose their grant, they won't get promoted, they'll be ridiculed by their peers, etc. And the main weapon used by the militant atheist crowd is scorn. It's not science and reason, it's scorn and contemptuous remarks and loud-mouthed comments and so on. So people are afraid of that. These people are bullies. So what's the way forward? Well, I think there are several ways forward, and I think some of them are happening right now. I think one is that people coming out of the closet and, not letting these people get away with it. And that's been happening quite a lot in the last few weeks, especially during this TED controversy. I've seen a change in mood I hadn't really seen happening with this intensity before. Now, of course, it means that people will still, within their medical and scientific institutions, find it hard to come out of the closet. But I think when they do, they'll find a lot of their colleagues agree with them. And I think that, more than anything, would change the atmosphere of the sciences and the medical profession, because when people come out of the closet, they'll find a lot of our colleagues want to do the same. Now, I think that's actually started to happen in some areas. Here in Britain, where we have very similar to America's dominant materialist bully types, I was asked to give a talk to a thing called the Special Interest Group of the Royal College of Psychiatrists, which is the main psychiatric professional body in Britain. I thought there'd be about 20 people. When I went into the room, there were about 400. And it turns out that about 1 in 7 of the Royal College of Psychiatrists now belong to this spirituality special interest group. And they can meet with their colleagues within framework of their professional institution and discuss meditation, prayer, healing, talk quite freely. And for most of them, it's a tremendous liberation. And I was at a medical conference 2 or 3 months ago here in Britain. It was called Medicine Unboxed. And it was organized by a free-thinking doctor who wanted to get his colleagues to a place where they could think more freely. And again, there were about 400 doctors there, mainly doctors and psychiatrists. And I talked very freely there, and they felt free to talk freely with each other. And this is the first time I've seen a medical professional organization where people could really talk about psychic phenomena, complementary medicine, spontaneous healing, the nature of remissions and so forth, the nature of consciousness and the mind. So I think that there are some changes happening. I think the medical professions, not the researchers, not the people in the pay of the drug companies, but kind of grassroots medical people, are perhaps becoming more open, at least in Britain. And I think the other thing that will change things is setting up alternative funding arrangements. I went to a meeting in the United States 2 or 3 months ago. Was a closed invitational meeting about science funding. And there were some pretty high-powered people there, people from major U.S. corporations, from the federal government, and so on. And they're now getting seriously worried, as is the British government, about something they call the innovation deficit. The reasoning here, which politicians are very into at the moment, is that the West can only compete with China, India, and in Asia by being more innovative. It can't compete in most areas of industrial production and so forth. But is the West being more innovative? Well, it used to be. Most of the breakthroughs that have changed our world have come out of the US and Europe. But is it still innovative? Where are the present breakthroughs? And if you look at the analysis of what's happened, there have been very, very few serious breakthroughs in the last 20 or 30 years. Most of the breakthroughs that have changed our lives, the invention of the internet, you know, transistors, radio, television, jet planes, you know, all these kinds of penicillin in medicine, heart transplants, all these kinds of things happened decades ago. The science in the last 10 or 20 years has been making incremental progress. For sure, it's been finding out a lot of new details, hundreds of thousands of papers get published in journals, and so on. A lot of activity, but it's obeying the law of diminishing return. More and more expense is getting fewer and fewer interesting results. So the policymakers are actually really worried about what's happening and are looking into the reasons for this innovation deficit. And one reason I was invited to this conference is because some of them have read my book, Science Set Free, and think that my analysis is part of the problem. You know, my analysis is highlighting part of the problem, the dogmatic constraints. Other constraints, other parts of the problem are the structure of institutional science and research and the system of incentives that people are incentivized within science and in medical research, not by practical outcomes that do good in the world. The incentives are getting papers published in high citation index peer-reviewed journals, which has got nothing to do with the real world. It's got a lot to do with the internal bubble of scientific institutions.
Let me ask you one final question before the end of the show that ties directly into what you're suggesting. In your view, the real blueprint of DNA resides in its morphological development, not from the code of genes. So I'd like you to explore this difference between genetic determinism that solely focuses on gene sequence and a morphogenic view on the development of life, and then add into that the epigenetic consequences of being aware of what we eat, the environment we're in, the emotions we have, the belief that we hold, as how that can manifest in the consequence to the gene, versus it doesn't matter what you eat, drink, it's all in the gene, because that would make an enormous difference if we embrace that morphological understanding. The final thought is yours.
Okay, how long have I got, Gary?
How about 5 minutes?
Okay, all right. I think that most inheritance depends on what I call morphic resonance. Now, I haven't in this conversation explain what I mean by it. It'll take more than 5 minutes to explain it. So I'll just have to say it's a kind of memory that's based on a resonance based on similarity. So when an embryo develops, it's shaped by morphogenetic fields, which are a kind of memory of the form of previous organisms. When an animal behaves instinctively, like a spider spinning a web or a weaver bird building a nest, it's following the habits of its species inherited by morphic resonance. The forms and shapes of our bodies are inherited by morphic resonance. The genes don't code for form or instinct or behavior. What they code for is the sequence of amino acids and proteins. They give us the right proteins, which, of course, we need, and genetic mutations can lead to defects. But most of inheritance is not in the genes. And the missing heritability problem has shown that about 75% of the inheritance of height or proneness to diseases or many other things is not accounted for by the genes. This is a recent discovery based on the Genome Project. It turns out they explain far, far less than people had assumed. And I think that's precisely because these aspects of inheritance depend on morphic resonance. Now, that morphic resonance means we are influenced by what our ancestors have learned and done and how they've behaved. And epigenetics is telling us that too. Epigenetics is a new recognition of the importance of heredity, what's happened in previous generations, was first discovered in the human realm, in that people who were descended from mothers and fathers who'd been in famines in the 19th century were quite different. Even two or three generations on, they had different enzymic balances, different health outcomes. There's now many examples of epigenetic inheritance that show how what people eat, how they behave, and the kind of lifestyle they've had can have consequences that influence their children and their children's children. Because through epigenetics, the expression of genes can be altered. Genes can be switched on or off. And this switching on or off can, to everyone's surprise, be carried over from generation to generation. No one expected that until about the year 2000. It wasn't known till then. People thought everything was just genetic. But this genetic dogmatism is fast coming unraveled. And a combination of epigenetic inheritance and morphic resonance sheds a whole new light on inheritance and on what we inherit and how what we do in our lives can be carried over into our children's lives, both through epigenetic modification and through morphic resonance.
Brilliant summary in such a short period of time. Of course, the science set free 10 past new discovery gives a much more wide-open understanding. The website is Sheldrake, sheldrake.org. Thank you very much for being with us again. I really appreciate your sharing this time with us.
It's my pleasure. Keep up the good work, Gary.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, my guest, and we look forward to another conversation with him. The study done by independent journalists of reviewing the peer-reviewed literature and the accusations of the quackbuster, in this case Stephen Barrett, against what had actually been written and stated and supported, Phil, you should read this. It's a real eye-opener to the politics behind and the lack of honest science behind the accusations and attacks by the quackbusters. It's up on the website now. Have a nice day, everyone. Now let's say hello to Utrice Lead, standing by. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. By popular vote, we continue with the conversation picking up from yesterday.
Great. Utrice Lead, in a moment.